BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I'm Donald McLeod, and thanks for downloading this highlights version of Composer of the Week. There's information on all the music you'll hear, as well as our terms of use, on the Radio 3 website at bbc.co.uk/radio3. In 1825, just 2 years before he died, Beethoven sent the parts of a new string quartet to four musician friends of his in Vienna. He attached this note: "Most excellent fellows, each of you is receiving herewith his part, and each of you undertakes to do his duty, and, what is more, pledges on his word of honour to acquit himself as well as possible, to distinguish himself, and to vie in excellence with the others. Each of you who is participating in the said undertaking must sign this paper." His friends would surely have been surprised. They'd assumed he'd given up on quartets. It had been nearly 15 years since he'd written one. But now, here he was again, exploring what might be possible with the string quartet. In these last 2 years of his life, he would complete only some 15 pieces of music, amongst which sit these final 5 quartets. These remarkable works have become known as Beethoven's Late Quartets, and their composition has come to be seen as a watershed moment not only in Beethoven's life, but in the history of classical music. This week, as Composer of the Week continues to tell the story of Beethoven's life and work to mark the 250th anniversary of his death, we're going to celebrate and explore these 5 extraordinary works. I'm delighted to be joined virtually from their respective homes in Oxford and Boulder, Colorado, by Laura Tunbridge, Professor of Music at the University of Oxford and author of a forthcoming book, Beethoven, A Life in 9 Pieces, and Ed Dusenberry, first violinist of the Tokarczuk Quartet, author of Beethoven for a Later Age, The Journey of a String Quartet. Ed, you know this music as a player, performing it over many years for audiences all over the world. For someone who doesn't know these pieces, what is it that makes them so important?
The music is so original and daring, and whether you're a player or a listener, it takes you in new and unexpected directions. And I have a particularly vivid memory of when we recorded Opus 127. We left the slow movement till the evening. Adrenaline was down, we were a bit less nervous. And in the middle of that slow movement, it was a very strange sensation of the music actually playing us. I almost felt like I wasn't playing at all. And I think that's something to do with the amazing emotional range and extraordinary storytelling. And it's always a vivid experience to play these pieces.
Laura, your book on Beethoven's most revealing pieces is going to be published this year. So you're also very close to this music. What is it, would you say, that the quartets offer us?
It's difficult not to feel overwhelmed by this music, by its reputation as much as anything else. But as Ed mentioned, it's the diversity of the music, its intensity and its capaciousness. It seems to encompass everything at once. It can be full of contrast and chaos, but still have coherence. It can seem abstract, but have lots of meanings and stories to tell. And it can be both very, very serious, but also have moments of levity and humour. And it's hard to think of music that can offer quite so much.
Well, there are 5 late quartets and we have 5 programmes. So each day we're going to be focusing on 1 quartet. And today it's the first of the series, the one which was published as his Opus 127. Laura, what should we listen out for here?
I think what it does here is introduce the sound world of the quartet, the different sonorities that are available from the combination of instruments. It begins with full chords and you can almost see in what you're hearing the quartet as they're moving as one. But the music doesn't give a clear sense of what the underlying meter is because offbeats are accented. So although you're moving together, you're somehow also off-footed. And then the first violin slips away from all of that. And the allegro then, by contrast, seems very winsome, almost too winsome for what we might expect of late Beethoven.
Thank you. As we imagine Beethoven sitting down to write these quartets, we get a sense of him, not for the first time in his career, determined to forge a new style of composition. Laura, what is it that Beethoven is doing differently this time round?
So many things. Partly unsettling everything, I think. You have a sense of him playing with conventional structure, but also with ideas of having a steady meter and constantly wrong-footing you. He's also starting to think about this music differently in terms of how he's producing it, in terms of how he's sketching it. So he still has sketchbooks for noting down ideas, but he's now beginning to develop them in what's called open score. So rather than only having two staves, he has more at his disposal, he uses four. And that means that he can begin to write for the individual instruments of the quartet more deliberately. And that changes the way that the relationship within the ensemble works out. So rather than having the typical 1+3 idea of the first violin, having all the melodic interest and everybody else accompanying, now each member of the quartet has greater independence and autonomy, and it allows him to explore much more complicated textures and ideas.
Ed, what kind of questions does this music raise about the roles of the instruments?
Well, as first violinist, I'm very aware, for example, in this piece, that sometimes they're very difficult things to do, but just because they're difficult doesn't mean that they're primary. So I might be playing a very high part, very exposed, but actually it's a descant to a cello tune, or I might have a very tricky bit of figuration, but it's just an equally shared melody with the second violin that's going to go back and forth. So he definitely questions your sense of the role of the first violin, and that's true for all the players.
We know it was a violinist who inspired Beethoven to turn to composing string quartets, the Viennese virtuoso Ignaz Schuppanzigh. They met shortly after Beethoven first arrived in Vienna, and Schuppanzigh gave Beethoven violin lessons. Ed, sitting in the leader's chair, how much of a sense of the character of this guy, Schuppanzigh, the player, do you get through the music?
Just from the music, I would have to guess that he was a very lively person and also very versatile. And we know that his playing was very spirited. Carl Czerny said that no one could get into the spirit of the music like him. And we also know that he was very innovative and entrepreneurial.
Well, actually, his entrepreneurial aspects were vital because he not only was an important player and could do a lot of the technical things that Beethoven wanted, but he also ran concert series and put together groups and was very well connected within Vienna. So he was important to actually make the performances happen. So he's both a collaborator and a promoter of Beethoven's music. And he believed in him so much that he endured quite a lot of teasing and ribbing and sometimes abuse from the composer as well.
Ed, we're going to hear the second movement of Opus 127 now. I think this is your favourite.
It's hard to choose a favourite, but if I did have to choose one, it would definitely be this movement. I think it has everything in it.
Maybe at this point we should get a little perspective on the quartet and the time of its creation, 1825. Laura, at this stage, was Beethoven's music fashionable in Vienna?
Fashionable, no. He was highly respected as a great composer in Vienna, but he's not flavour of the month as he had been a decade earlier. By the 1820s, opera is more popular than instrumental music, especially the operas of Rossini and, to a lesser extent, Weber. So Beethoven is very respected, but he's rather old school for the musical genres in which he's writing. And because in other ways he's taken himself out of public life, he's no longer frequenting salons and teaching as he had done as a young man. He's almost becoming a classic like Mozart and Haydn.
This quartet, the first of the five late ones that we're looking at this week, was completed, as I said, in 1825, so just a year after the premiere of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Ed, can you see parallels between the series of symphonies and the series of quartets?
Yes, particularly in the sense of them being cycles of works, and also the amazing way in which the Ninth Symphony ends, so surprising with the voices in the last movement. And so I think this sense of overthrowing expectations is something that's very important in the late quartets, and a sense of great experimentation also with endings.
Laura, you've suggested that we hear the very opening of the finale of the Ninth, this absolutely unprecedented introduction of voices in symphonic music. What do you think this music helps us understand about the late quartets or this quartet?
I think partly it's helpful to think about genres being in dialogue with one another rather than treating them as separated. It's still the same composer, after all. And then you have Beethoven experimenting with structure, with timbre and meaning in the Ninth Symphony. It's a kind of larger scale working out of the more unusual aspects of the string quartets. The entry of the singing voices is obviously key and important, and that tends to be the aspect that we concentrate on. But actually, what's also interesting about the start of this finale is the way that Beethoven cycles through music from previous movements. He does similar things in the quartets, but they don't always head towards a similarly huge climactic ending. And it's that idea of playing with what an ending should be that I think is interesting. The American Beethoven scholar Maynard Solomon wrote that in early Beethoven, all happy endings were more or less alike. For late period Beethoven, all happy endings are dissimilar because they are uncertain.
There are differing accounts of the first performance of the Ninth Symphony. One of them offers us the image of Beethoven standing in front of the conductor, beating time, dressed in a green frock coat because he didn't have a formal black dress coat. His wardrobe was never extensive. His hearing by this stage was so bad that one version has him still conducting when the symphony had ended. He could neither hear the music nor the applause which erupted at the end, and supposedly he had to be turned around to see the audience. Beethoven pulled out of the first advertised date for the premiere in January 1825 because he wasn't happy with the quartet. It was eventually given on the 6th of March, but Beethoven hid away, probably thinking that he simply wouldn't be able to hear how the performance went. This was a big deal for the performers, who were under a lot of pressure playing the first new quartet by Beethoven after such a long gap. Expectations would have been very high. Laura, how did it go?
Not too well. You have to bear in mind that it was done on very little rehearsal, and it's difficult music to read even when it's printed well. There were copying errors, including Beethoven having mistakenly used the alto clef for the cello at one point in the finale. One of Chopin's strings broke, and then the individual parts are tricky, but playing them together in some ways is even harder.
Ed, this performance was a disaster for Chopin-Sieg, who didn't have a chance to rehearse adequately. How do you rehearse these pieces?
Yes, the story of Schuppensieg's first performance being a disaster is something that I try desperately not to think about just before I go on stage. It's not at all helpful. This piece has multiple challenges because the first two movements, as we've heard, have tremendous emotional range, but the third and fourth movements have a lot of technical difficulties and also the issue of stamina. So there's quite a lot of nuts and bolts, sort of careful, slow preparation, building things up, treating it with a great deal of respect.
Chopin-Sieg got the blame for the failure of the first performance, but he didn't get a chance at a second. He was booted out by the other players in favour of a new leader, Josef Böhm. it still fell apart. The quartet played it twice, but Beethoven's nephew Karl told him they were scarcely in a condition to play it two times. The heat was very great. They sweated a lot. One can imagine the audience clapping rather tentatively after the second time through, in case they were subjected to a third. Laura, there must have been particular challenges in this next movement, the whirling scherzo, with its clever contrapuntal games.
Yes, I mean, it's worth remembering that they didn't have a whole score to look at, so they were piecing things together as individuals. The scherzo begins with the whole quartet playing plucked chords, almost as if it's finished before it's begun.
Ed, you've spent many hours recording these quartets and thinking about your interpretation as a group, able to retake things as often as you like until you're all satisfied, a luxury those first players obviously didn't have. It's something you've written about very tellingly. What sort of journey is that? What are the kind of decisions that you agonize over?
There are so many different ways to play this music in terms of even the characters, the moods that you convey, and of course, the tempi. And we find that whenever we come back to them, we're always trying new ideas. I think in recent years, our focus has been even more on how the piece ends, because there's a rather extraordinary withdrawal from music that has been rather rambunctious and almost rude in its jollity. And then it suddenly becomes very ethereal, but at the same time, there's a sense of triumph right at the end, and to try and combine those things is very tricky and something that one's happy to have many chances to try.
Laura, you're particularly interested in the different ways Beethoven ends these late quartets. Tell us about the ending of this one.
The finale is another slightly off-kilter dance, and then the coda, as happens in other of the late quartets, seems like a separate entity. Musicologist Joseph Kerman described the ending of the quartet as a whole as dissolving, which I think captures it really nicely.
I'm Jess Gillam, I play the saxophone, and I really think you should subscribe to my new podcast, This Classical Life. If you're like me and always listening to music, this is a great new way of discovering sounds for your playlists.
It's when I want something really groovy and really funky.
Every week I'm joined by a special guest and we share the latest tracks we just can't stop playing.
I also have this playlist on my phone called 5am and it's full of classical music.
Just head to BBC Sounds and subscribe to This Classical Life.
In March 1931, the poet T.S. Eliot, then in his late 40s, wrote to his friend and fellow poet Stephen Spender, "I have the A minor quartet on the gramophone, the opus 132, one of the six late quartets of Beethoven, and I find it quite inexhaustible to study. There is a sort of heavenly, or at least more than human, gaiety about some of his later things, which one imagines might come to oneself as the fruit of reconciliation and relief after immense suffering. I should like to get something of that into verse before I die. The time of creation of that quartet, Opus 132, was indeed a period of suffering and turmoil for Beethoven, a time of reconciliation, of dashed dreams, of at last finding a life partner. Today, I'll be focusing on that work as part of a week of programmes exploring the world of the extraordinary late quartets. I'll be looking at what Beethoven was going through at this point and trying to get a sense of what sort of state of mind these pieces emerge from. But before we hear anything from our quartet today, let's hear one of the last things Beethoven wrote before he set to work on it. It shares a spiritual connection with the late quartets, part of the last piano music Beethoven would ever compose. One of Beethoven's Opus 126 bagatelles. Those bagatelles were written, in part, to pay a debt to his brother Johann. Beethoven was plagued by financial worries at this time, as indeed he was throughout most of his life. He was, as ever, in debt. He was hemorrhaging money right, left and centre. There were doctor's bills to pay, and he was mismanaging his own affairs chaotically, maintaining more than one apartment to live in, keeping two servants, and trying to set some money aside to support his nephew Karl, whose guardian he'd become after his brother Karl's death. The guardianship didn't go well. Beethoven was very heavy-handed and controlling, and eventually, inevitably, Karl rebelled. Beethoven's last big concert, the premiere of the Ninth Symphony, the previous year, 1824, had been an artistic triumph, but a financial disaster. Ed, is this music, Opus 132, the music of a desperate man? How much did he need these quartets financially and emotionally?
One can certainly hear at times the turbulence, a sense of despair and isolation. But I also find it very moving that in order to be able to play this piece, the four players need an amazing degree of cooperation and communication. So it's as if Beethoven was imagining these ideal relationships in the string quartet that were so elusive to him in his life.
Laura, how did these quartets actually come about?
Beethoven received a commission from Prince Galitzin in St. Petersburg for some string quartets. He said he'd like one, two or three and that he should tell him his fee. Galitzin was a keen cellist and a huge admirer of Beethoven, as were a number of Russian noblemen. But he became a little impatient as the composer worked on other pieces instead of the quartets, and they included the Missa Solemnis and the Ninth Symphony. And there's a suggestion that when he actually received the three quartets, he would have preferred something more like Beethoven's earlier works than the late style that we have.
Ed, among other particular things that you look forward to playing in this quartet?
It has an extraordinary eerie beginning, slow chords, very creepy. But the quartet is pulling together at that moment. But then there's a scream from the first violin, and pretty quickly the music becomes volatile and the voices kind of pulling against each other. So there's a lot of anguish and turbulence. And then every now and again in the second theme, there's a beautiful sense of escape, as though Beethoven's trying to reach out to a better world.
I get a kind of feeling in listening to this music that we're almost inside Beethoven's head as he tries to find a way forward.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And that's a bit of a challenge as a performer, because obviously you have to retain some degree of control in order to play the instrument. But Beethoven expects us to really inhabit that very volatile, destabilizing emotional space.
What comes next is an ethereal folk-like minuet and trio, but we're going to move on to talk about the third movement now, because it's one of those precious moments in Beethoven's output where his biography and creativity directly intertwine. I mentioned that one of the drains on his finances at this time was paying his doctor's bills. He was seriously ill, his liver was failing, and while he waits to see if he's dying, he concentrates his energies on these quartets. He told his nephew Karl that work on them was going tolerably well, which it was until the spring of 1825, when he developed a severe bowel inflammation. He had bleeding from his mouth and nose. Beethoven's biographer Jan Swofford suggests that we can hear that brush with death in the music of this quartet. Laura, what sort of measures did poor Beethoven take to improve the state of his health?
It's always terrifying to hear what 19th century doctors did to their patients. And Beethoven got through a lot of physicians. In this instance, he was advised to follow a restricted diet, so to cut back on alcohol and caffeine, which was always difficult for him. He was very fond of both. The other thing he did, as he did for many summers, was to go to a spa town to take the waters. In this instance, he goes to Baden, which is where he starts writing this next movement, the Heiliger Dankgesang.
So the full title is Heiliger Dankgesang eines Genesenen an die Gottheit in der lydischen Tonart, which translates as Holy Song of Thanksgiving to the Deity from a Convalescent in the Lydian Mode. Ed, tell us about this Song of Thanksgiving. What sense of Beethoven's ordeal do we get in the music?
I think we get a sense of him composing his way into a better place. He was initially, at least, feeling physically much better. And especially after the first movement, there's a tremendous sense of relief and gratitude.
Laura, there's some intriguing tempo markings here, not in conventional Italian, but in German, in fact.
They are unusual for being in German, although Beethoven does that a little bit. In the years beforehand. More importantly, they suggest a conventional quality, a personal quality to what's meant by the tempo here. At one point we have with new strength, and then also we have a passage which is marked to be played with the most private feeling. They're not exactly tempo markings, they're expression markings, but they give some sense of something special happening.
Ed, you've said, I think, that some of your most memorable experiences as a performer have been playing just this movement.
Yes, that's for a couple of reasons. When you're in the right type of hall and the piece is going well, there's a kind of stillness that comes across the audience and can last throughout the movement. And that's very powerful to feel part of that. And at the same time, sometimes you have the experience of playing the piece when maybe someone in the group is not actually feeling well. And that brings home to me a very important element of this music and when it was written. Because actually Beethoven wasn't consistently feeling better. In fact, just a few days later, he complained to his nephew Karl that he was feeling ill again. And so you get a sense that this gratitude in the music is a statement of faith. It's an attitude that may not always bear a relation to the actual circumstances. Thank you.
What follows that incredible, intense outpouring of emotion presents a dramatic contrast. But before we hear from the final two movements of the quartet, let's talk about something we'll encounter there, something that Beethoven is experimenting with in these later quartets, recitative. Ed, it's an operatic term where the singer's allowed to adopt the rhythms and accents of ordinary speech. What does that mean for an instrumentalist like you?
In this context, there's a sense of improvisation, of declamation, and also musically of it being a bridge from one thing, from this celestial ending to what we're next going to hear.
Is it hard material to play? Is it difficult to get agreement on among the quartet?
Actually, I love this passage because the slow movement, while being absolutely wonderful, is quite confining in a certain way, and you feel like you're treading on eggshells. And here there are less rules and I think more freedom. Sometimes you have to, you know, have some discussion about the exact pacing and rubato, but all of us are quite happy to let our hair down a little bit here.
Beethoven's only opera, Fidelio, had been revived just a few years earlier. In this extract we're going to hear, we get a sense of Beethoven's traditional use of recitative in one of the revisions he made to the opera. Laura, how does the extract from Fidelio that we're going to hear help us understand what Beethoven's doing in those instrumental passages?
I think what it does is illustrate that what Beethoven has in mind as recitative isn't everyday speech. It's declamatory, but it's expressive, it's heightened, so it can be dramatic and swiftly become song-like too. And I think that's what's being gathered into the medium of the quartet. It's that range of emotions that are compressed and contained in the idea of the singing voice.
The English conductor and composer George Smart came to Vienna in the autumn of 1825 to get the correct tempo markings for the Ninth Symphony, direct from the composer, so he could give its British premiere. And he was there in time to catch the first outing of Opus 132 on September the 9th. It wasn't a grand affair. It took place in a hot, stuffy room in a tavern at the Sign of the Wild Man. Laura, we heard yesterday about the disastrous unveiling of Opus 127. How did this one go?
Much better. But then it was for an invited audience and the piece was played through twice, so both the listeners and the quartet could get a better sense of what was going on. Apparently, Beethoven conducted from the score, which I don't think means conducted in the sense that we think of it today. He was sort of nestled within the quartet, marking tempi, the speed at which they should be taking things, and also to demonstrate things. Famously, he was supposed to have seized the second violinist Holtz's violin to demonstrate some bowing, and also was very much engaged in the performance and maybe even ribbing the performers about how they could or couldn't manage to play his new piece.
Ed, one of the challenges of the first read-through is presumably the segues between movements. This is the first of the late quartets to really make a point of expanding out of the conventional four-movement structure and playing with the idea of transitions. Had anyone done this before?
It creates really quite a different balance between the movements, and it makes one think of something like a serenade. Beethoven wrote a string trio in D major serenade, Mozart divertimenti, even Bach suites. And the transitions are some of my favorite moments, or at least juxtapositions. For example, after the slow movements, Beethoven shatters the mood with a really rude march. And one of my favorite post-concert reactions was a woman who came backstage and was completely outraged that Beethoven could have ruined this piece by putting such a ridiculous bit of trite music. She was incensed. And I thought Beethoven would have just loved that reaction.
Absolutely. Beethoven loved walking in the open air, getting out of the confines of his various apartments in Vienna to roam the woods and fields that then surrounded the city. The von Breuning family were childhood friends in his native Bonn, and Stefan von Breuning moved to Vienna about a decade after Beethoven did. Stefan's son, Gerhard, who was then a boy of 12, recalled encountering the composer on one of his daily excursions in 1825. A man walking alone was heading straight towards us. He was powerful-looking, of medium height, vigorous in his gait and lively movements, his clothing far from elegant or conventional, and there was something about him overall that did not fit into any classification. He spoke almost without pause, asking how we were, what we were doing now, about relatives on the Rhine, and many other matters. My father seldom had a chance to get a word in. That little vignette gives us a really colourful impression of Beethoven as a man, the chatterbox, all these ideas bubbling out of him without let-up. Von Breuning's recollection is from around the time that Beethoven was working on his Opus 130 string quartet, the one we're focusing on today. Laura, do we get a sense of that unstoppable flow in this Opus 130 quartet?
Yes, we certainly do. There's a great energy to this music, which you hear especially in the second movement, a presto that whirs through ideas very quickly. Now, on the surface, they're quite simple ideas. They move down or up. It's the rhythm and the phrasing that lend it life and interest. And we've heard some quite substantial movements from the late quartets, but this one is gone in the blink of an eye.
Well, today we're going to jump into this quartet with the second movement. Ed, how do you approach this quicksilver presto? One writer I read spoke of the first violin line hovering above a moat of snapping crocodiles.
That's a great image. I take a very deep breath before starting this. The musicologist Joseph Kerman described this opening section as furious whispering, which I love as an idea. And in the middle section, it really feels like the first violin goes up in smoke. And in concert, when you get to the end of this movement, you can often hear an actual vocal reaction, a kind of an outtake of breath.
This quartet was another one which was slow to come together. Laura, did we know why it took him so long?
Not exactly. I mean, in some ways, with the last quartet, you could say it was periods of illness that delayed him. Here, it seems in some ways it's more likely to have been ambition because of the scale of the quartet. It has six movements rather than conventional four, and the movements themselves are far from conventional, as we just heard. He also spent a long time debating how to finish it, what he should do with the finale.
What kind of demand was there for string quartets?
It's interesting, it's changed slightly. Earlier in his career, Beethoven had written quartets for patrons such as Count Razumovsky and Prince Galitzin, and they wanted them to be played by their in-house ensembles. Now, by the 1820s, it was publishers, music publishers, who were getting interested in getting hold of new quartet music, and public demand was rapidly outstripping what Beethoven could supply. There's a tension here, though. Publishers wanted to work with a celebrated composer, which Beethoven certainly was, but they wanted something more accessible than the late quartets, which even professional musicians found it hard to get to grips with. People were still mostly making music at home, so arrangements of the quartets for other instruments were still important, just as they were for symphonies and opera. So there was demand, but whether it was demand for the kind of music that Beethoven supplied is a different question.
Ed, what would the life of a professional string quartet have been like at this time?
It would have been complex, and we know a fair amount about Schuppansich and his colleagues in the quartet, and Laura talked about this being a time of great flux, great change. It was an insecure and unpredictable income. And maybe the best analogy, in some ways, it's quite similar today to a quartet that is starting out, but still has to balance the quartet rehearsals with other opportunities, perhaps an orchestral job. The second violinist, Karl Holtz, was actually a civil servant, and there's some complaints about them not finding enough time to rehearse because of the different schedule. So it was a complicated period.
We're going to hear the third and fourth movements of Opus 130. They are a pair, aren't they? So what's Beethoven trying to do here?
I think there's a sort of feeling of incidental music, again, a little bit like a serenade, almost as if Beethoven is disarming us, putting us into a false sense of security for what's actually going to happen later in the piece.
The premiere of this quartet took place in a one-off concert on the 21st of March, 1826. Beethoven didn't attend the concert himself. He hid in a nearby tavern and had Karl Holtz, the second violinist of Schuppansich's quartet, and acting for a while as his own unpaid secretary, report back to him. It went pretty well. The second and fourth movements were spontaneously encored. Laura, how much do we know about that audience and what they made of it?
We don't know too much about the makeup of the audience. It wasn't unusual for them to encore movements immediately. What seems strange to us now is that we couldn't dream of interrupting a performance of a late Beethoven quartet by saying, actually, we'd like to hear this one again. So, I mean, from that point of view, it shows that they weren't serious connoisseurs, as we might imagine the audience to be. And so he's playing on the one hand to connoisseurs, but he is also prepared to give these movements where people could respond to them more easily and that they would fit within a concert programme that had a variety of genres and types of music on it.
Ed, these late quartets have something of a reputation for being unremittingly serious, awesomely serious music. But when Beethoven heard about the audience response to the middle movements, he was indignant and scoffed, "What, those trifles?" Is there a tinge of humour or absurdity in those movements?
There's definitely humour, lightness, Beethoven alluding to more popular music. But I think he's not being quite straightforward when he describes them as trifles. As a player, when you look at that Alla Tedesca, there's so many instructions in every bar, little hairpins up and down, and Beethoven marks these hairpins to play suddenly a bit louder and then back away from it. So they're detailed dynamic instructions. They may also, in the context of a dance, refer to tempo, to play with a little bit of rubato or a little bit of swing. So there's a lot of instructions in a piece that he describes as a trifle.
Well, let's step away from the quartet for a moment to hear a bit of earlier Beethoven in crowd-pleasing, playful mode. Like Opus 130, this piano sonata also features in its first movement another German dance, a la Tedesca, as its first movement. Curiously, an inversion of the same theme. Is Beethoven parodying himself, maybe? Beethoven's string quartet, Opus 130, had its first public outing in March 1826, and we know from contemporary reports that there was copious applause after the second and the fourth movements. But for many audiences, since that time, the movement with the greatest emotional response has been the fifth movement, the Cavatina. We know from his friend Karl Holtz that this music moved Beethoven himself to tears. We've just had three lighter movements, and now Beethoven gives us in this Cavatina one of the most heartfelt pieces ever written by him or anyone else. Laura, what makes this so remarkable?
It's partly the surprise of suddenly moving to something so much more intimate and interior. And then this is music that seems to speak perhaps directly from or to the heart, because it's so direct in some ways and then also very elusive. It also moves from something which is the whole group working together and then into a more anxious or uneasy section. It's marked beklemmt, which means just that. It means to be anxious or uneasy. And the first violin somehow seems to be doubting themselves in terms of what they should be doing, how they should continue.
Ed, you've said that within this movement comes, for you perhaps, the most special moment in the whole cycle of Beethoven quartets.
Yes, the section that Laura mentioned, the beklemmt, which is quite hard to translate, but maybe afflicted or anguished or constricted. It's exactly the opposite of the expressiveness at the beginning. And I feel that Beethoven here is tapping into that sense that we all sometimes have of extreme pain, but not being able to express it. And so there's a choked quality to the first violin part, a vulnerability. And it's a strange mixture of things, because on the one hand, it's about loneliness. But in the sense that we've all experienced something like that in the audience and the communication between audience and player, there's also a sense of tremendous connection.
Music which, as we sit here, is hurtling on through interstellar space beyond the bounds of our solar system. A recording of it, the Cavatina from Beethoven's String Quartet, Opus 130, by the Budapest String Quartet, is one of the musical examples on the golden disc aboard the Voyager spacecraft launched in 1977, taking samples of human culture to whoever out there might find it. One of the choices that performers of this quartet have to make is which ending to go for. Beethoven comes up with two responses to the cavatina that shatter the mood. Laura, this is a quartet, in a way, all about endings. Why are there two?
Beethoven originally wrote a huge finale, a movement that was longer than whole quartets had previously been, the Grosse Fuge, or Great Fugue. It's massive and complex and completely befuddled the audience when it was first played. The first publisher of the quartet recommended that for the sake of balance, it should be published separately. Slightly surprisingly, Beethoven agreed and wrote an alternative, shorter and lighter movement that was published as part of Opus 130, with the Grosse Fuge being published as Opus 133.
Beethoven had long been fascinated by this very rigorous form, the fugue. His teacher, Albrechtsberger, had drilled Beethoven in all the devices of manipulating a fugal subject, but said, one can rarely employ them all in one fugue. Laura, is that what he's trying to do here?
Yes, of course he is. There's a bravura aspect to this movement that he is showing his ability to compose such a complex work. He's composed quite a few fugues in this last decade, but this really does feel like a catalogue of all the things that can be done within the rules and beyond them.
Ed, in your book, you say, sometimes I wish he hadn't composed the fugue.
Yes, I mean, it's a thrilling, exhilarating piece to play, but also dangerous. And that's partly because the parts seem to be arguing with each other so much. Beethoven apparently sat between the two violins during the rehearsals for this and burst into laughter when the first violin was having difficulty. And I'm afraid that particular story has haunted me over these many years.
Beethoven evidently cared about the response to this movement the most and called the hearers who failed to have it encored cattle and asses. The fugue, we're told, had passed by uncomprehended. A local paper corroborated this, describing the music as incomprehensible, like Chinese. So, Laura, what changed? How long did it take for people to appreciate them?
In many ways, it took decades, if not a century, of performers getting to grips with the music and really managing to play it convincingly, and also for subsequent generations of composers and critics to start to reconceive their idea about what Beethoven had done, to start to think of it not as being weird and bad music, but weird and good music, that the challenge is something that's artistically significant rather than something that meant that Beethoven had somehow lost his mind.
Ed, what sort of responses have you had to this in your performances of it?
It continues to provoke very strong reactions, people who are firm advocates of this and people who can't stand it. And when we do the whole cycle, which is usually six concerts, we finish the whole cycle by playing 130 with the Grosse Fuge, because for us, there's nothing like it and it's the right way to end the cycle.
As Beethoven's biographer Jan Swofford has put it, the enigma that crowns perhaps the most enigmatic work of Beethoven's life. The original ending, the Grosse Fuge, of Beethoven's String Quartet, Opus 130. Gerhard von Breuning, the little boy whose impression of a bustling Beethoven we heard at the start, told Beethoven the quartet did not go over very well, to which Beethoven responded, "It will please them someday." It may have taken another 20-odd years for there to be another outing for that fugue, but it seems Beethoven had an inkling that people would come round to it eventually. When it came to relationships, Beethoven had issues. The British aristocrat John Russell wrote an account of his tour in Germany, on which he met the composer, in 1822. To Russell, the most celebrated of the living composers, the foremost of his day, was a man lost to society in consequence of his extreme deafness, which has rendered him almost unsocial. The neglect of his person, which he exhibits, gives him a somewhat wild appearance. His general behaviour does not ill accord with the unpromising exterior. Except when he is among his chosen friends, kindliness or affability are not his characteristics. Russell gives an account of Beethoven sitting in his habitual corner in his favourite tavern and taking umbrage when a stranger sat too close to him, glaring at the man and spitting on the floor, eventually yelling at the stranger and stomping out of the place. Russell concludes, even among his closest friends, he must be humoured like a wayward child. In this week, looking at Beethoven's late string quartets, we'll be homing in on his personal relationships around the time he was writing them. Today's quartet is Opus 131, the fourth of the five late quartets, this one written during an especially turbulent time in the composer's family life. Ed, before we get into the quartet, we're going to hear some piano music you've chosen that has a connection to playing this music for you. Tell us about it.
Yes, it's very interesting to hear that vivid description of Beethoven and recognise that he could create music of such luminous beauty and delicacy as the first movement of the Piano Sonata Opus 109. This is a recording by Richard Good that I listened to over and over again when I was learning the late quartets. I was in Taos, New Mexico, staying outside of the town near the mountains, and I used to sit outside by a little stream and listen to this music, and the sense of fantasy in his playing and in the music was a wonderful inspiration as I was starting to discover the quartets.
As 1825 drew to a close, Beethoven returned to his sketchbooks, riding on the energy of the three quartets he'd just written to a commission from the Russian prince Galitzin. The new quartet, Opus 131, was different. This one was not a commission. He wrote it for himself. So, does writing for himself mean Beethoven is happier on the domestic front? Not a bit of it. He was perpetually grumpy with his servants. It was a literally thankless task working for him. He wrote to his brother Johann in 1825, "I can't put up any longer with this old witch who 200 years ago would certainly have been burned." His quarters were, we're reliably informed, a spectacle of dust and confusion. The composer commandeered his friend Stefan von Breuning's wife to oversee the housekeeping and manage the servants. Frau von Breuning resisted invitations to dine, say Beethoven, but Beethoven spent quite a lot of time with the Breunings, and on one occasion he burst out in delighted laughter at a dinner party with the family when their daughter let out a piercing shriek because he could hear it. Laura, how much is his deafness at this stage affecting his relationships?
A great deal. He's having to communicate with friends, family and servants by conversation books and even chalkboards. And his social circles have been reduced to a small group of friends who are mostly male, and they visit him at home or they go to local taverns, although, as you've laid out, he wasn't exactly social when he was there. It was more that he enjoyed spending time with the people who he trusted.
Another person whom Beethoven sees on a regular basis at this time is his friend, the violinist Karl Holz. What does he get out of that friendship?
Well, Holtz was one of a long line of young men who does a lot of what you might think of as dog's body work, helping Beethoven with his correspondence and daily business. And he's also the second violinist in Chopin's Ex Quartet, and perhaps most importantly for Beethoven, he's also a good drinking companion.
We know from sketches Beethoven made at this time, more than 600 pages of them, and five sets of plans for movements, that Opus 131 wasn't a work which came easily to Beethoven. There's a parallel with his home life. The music is unsettled and roving, moving through six different keys. Ed, the quartet is designated as being in C-sharp minor, the key of the opening movement. His only other work in that key is the opening to the so-called Moonlight Sonata. This is, I think, a notoriously problematic key for strings.
Yes, different keys make the instruments resonate in different ways, and C-sharp minor is a key that doesn't make the instrument sound open. Instead, it has a beautifully repressed, kind of covered, secretive quality to it. And that also allows Beethoven then, in this immense journey of this piece, to move into very contrasting keys. So we'll then hear D major and A major that are much more open.
The saddest thing ever said in notes, so said Richard Wagner, famously, of that music. The first movement of Beethoven's String Quartet, Opus 131. We've already heard this week how Beethoven's relationship with his nephew Karl, whose guardian he'd become, was a major preoccupation at this time. He tried to control every aspect of Karl's life. Karl, in his late teens, naturally rebelled. There was constant friction, endless rows, and the whole situation reached boiling point around the time he was finishing Opus 131. Their arguments grew so ferocious that they were asked to move out by their landlord. But there was worse to come. Karl was driven to the point where he felt he had no way out. He pawned his watch, bought two pistols, and tried to shoot himself in the head. Somehow or other, he managed not to kill himself. While Beethoven was evidently devastated, his attitude was to reproach the lad and think only of himself, complaining to Frau von Breuning about the disgrace he has caused me. I loved him so much. Ed, what is it about this thoroughly toxic relationship that matters to Beethoven so much in his final years?
Well, I think at a time that he felt so isolated, this was really his last chance for a familial bond, and he just couldn't let it go in some way. Probably Beethoven's idealism really got in the way here, that he was unable to be accepting of the relationship as it was.
Laura, what kind of effect would you say this very complicated relationship had on Beethoven and his writing?
It's very difficult to tell. What's really striking is that while Beethoven was, of course, upset and distracted by everything that had happened and was happening with Karl, he carries on composing. More slowly than previously, perhaps, but then it's quite complicated music. It's a sense that he turns to music in part to respond to or explore whatever is going on in his personal life.
Ed, we're about to hear your recording with the Tokarczuk Quartet of the next three movements, which form a centre of the quartet. What should we listen out for here?
And this second movement is fleeting, and there's an outdoors quality to it. And there's something miraculous when we play this piece, that whenever you reach the next movement, it just feels like you're exactly ready to play it. ¶¶
As well as the commission from Prince Galitzin to write the first three of these late five quartets, Beethoven was spurred on by the return to Vienna of his friend, the violinist Ignaz Schuppanzigh, who'd been away in St. Petersburg for 7 years. The subscription concert he set up made string quartets public music for the concert hall, not just the privacy of performance at home. Schuppanzigh established his own string quartet, which Beethoven called his Leibquartett, personal quartet. Laura, who were the other players and how did they work together?
Some of the musicians were people that Beethoven had known for a long time. So the viola player Franz Weiss and also the cellist Joseph Linke. The youngest member was the violinist Karl Holtz, who we've already heard about, who was 20 years younger than the others. He worked as a civil servant, but he also played as second violinist in the quartet and also functioned as Beethoven's unpaid secretary for a while. Holtz in particular was really good at having quiet words with Beethoven to patch things up after there'd been misunderstandings or arguments.
Ed, Karl Holtz was a young addition to the quartet, as you were when you joined the Tokarczuk at the age of 25. I imagine your approach to playing this music has changed with age.
Yes, I mean, understandably, I was quite daunted by a lot of things when I joined the quartet. And as you get older and also after we'd made our recording, I started to see the music opening up in a certain way, and particularly this sense of fantasy and improvisation and feeling that one could take more risks with it. There's also a tremendous sense of fun and of carefree music. So I think it's just become a broader experience for me.
Beethoven loved to hurl musical jokes at Schuppanzigh. We're going to hear Lob auf der Dicken in praise of the fat one, which begins, Schuppanzigh ist ein Lump. Schuppanzigh is a rogue.
Schuppanzigh ist ein Lump. Lump, Lump. Wer kennt ihn nicht? Den dicken Saumagen, den aufgeblasenen Eselskopf.
Oh, Lump.
Schuppanzigh.
Oh, Esel.
Schuppanzigh.
Wir stimmen alle ein, du bist der größte Esel.
It seems that Beethoven himself held this quartet in especially high regard. When he finished, it was 130, he called that his favourite. When he completed this quartet, he called it his greatest. Laura, why do you think he was so proud of this work?
I think musicians always like their last piece the best. So I think there's an element in which he's describing these works in favourable terms because they're freshest for him. But there is also a sense that this is a piece that's not exactly written to commission. There's a freedom here, an ability for him to do what he wants with it that he must have appreciated.
For some, this quartet we've been talking about today was the last major work Beethoven composed. So this represents the end of his heart. So this represents the end of his art. But what followed, in his biographer Jan Swofford's words, were after effects and asterisks. Ed, what sort of place does this quartet take us to?
It is a complete universe. There's something just wondrous about the way the movements follow one after another with such extraordinary contrast and seemingly lack of preparation, and yet somehow or other they make complete sense.
We're moving towards the end of the piece now with the final three movements. What's coming up?
So we have a scherzo, which has a ridiculously mundane theme. And I think if a student composer would bring in this theme and also the way that it's treated, the teacher might say, well, can't you vary a little bit more? I mean, there's quite a lack of variety in a certain way, and it's very intentionally that way. There's tremendous humour in it. And then right towards the end, an extraordinary distortion of sound when we're all asked to play on the bridge. And while the audience is still in a kind of surprised mirth, a movement comes to a sudden stop. And then this is really my favourite moment in the piece. We hear in this very sad key of G sharp minor, a viola tune. It's like an inner confession, and so appropriate that Beethoven chose the viola. There aren't many such melodies for the viola in the quartets, and this is a really remarkable one.
Laura, there's been a sense of perpetual motion. In fact, there isn't a double bar until after the final note. What does the ending say in this quartet?
This music seems like it needs never to end, that it's just constantly inventing and reinventing itself. You can hear that almost in the closing gestures, constantly alternating between soft and loud, and actually which one is going to win out in the end? How eventually is it all just going to come to a close? Constantly asking those questions, and eventually there you have it.
Beethoven never got to hear that quartet himself. Perhaps the general bafflement which greeted the performance of his Opus 130 and its incomprehensible final fugue meant no more performances happened before Beethoven's death. Richard Wagner wrote of the end of the work, "This is the fury of the world's dance. Fierce pleasure, agony, ecstasy of love, joy, anger, passion, and suffering, lightning flashes and thunder rolls. And above the tumult, the indomitable fiddler whirls us on to the abyss. Amid the clamour, he smiles, for to him it is nothing but a mocking fantasy. At the end, the darkness beckons him away, and his task is done." I can imagine some of the locals frightening their children into obedience with the threat that if they didn't do as they were told, that weird, scruffy, dishevelled chap who'd recently appeared walking through the woods and fields, roaring and humming to himself and waving his arms about, would come and take them away. Even the sheep and cattle in the fields would bolt in fright when they saw him coming. At the end of September 1826, Beethoven and his nephew Karl went to stay with Ludwig's brother Johann on the estate he'd bought at Wasserhof near Gneixendorf in the wine-growing area up the Danube from Vienna, so that Karl could recuperate after trying to blow his brains out. Beethoven took to his usual habit of wandering around in the countryside, composing in his head and causing considerable alarm among the local inhabitants by his strange behaviour. They thought he must be mad. To audiences in Vienna in the 1820s, Beethoven's late string quartets certainly seemed to have elements of madness in their baffling, unprecedented music. It's those late works of chamber music that we've been looking at all this week, and today we've reached the final quartet. He set to work on Opus 135 right after he'd finished Opus 131, but this one is quite different from its predecessors. What marks it out, Laura?
It's on a smaller scale. It goes back to having the conventional four movements. And in some ways, it's of a lighter and more carefree character than what had happened in that great exploration of the mammoth Opus 131.
Yes, there's a quicksilver quality, especially to the first movement and the way that the melodic lines are handed rather gracefully between the parts.
Well, it falls to the viola to begin this Opus 135 quartet with a four-note question. But it doesn't sound, from the answer, as if this is going to be about the great eternal questions.
Thank you.
The overall theme of our conversation today is going to be an exploration of what late Beethoven is, especially in the context of these remarkable last five quartets. It might be helpful to get a perspective if we look back over our shoulders at earlier Beethoven. Laura, could you give us an outline of the Beethoven of the Eroica, the Fifth Symphony, the Appassionata Sonata? Who is that?
That's Beethoven's hero, if you will. He's being bold and struggling. The narratives around this music is always about overcoming, of being victorious in the face of adversity. It's music that's about asserting himself within the world, about celebrating a certain idea of heroism, and also being insistent that his way is the right way, I think.
To what extent does Beethoven move away from something, romanticism, that he'd had a hand in creating?
I think there's a sense in which the proportions are different. There's much more sense of wanting to balance one mood with another. And actually, in the case of Opus 135, it's clearly a late quartet, but it's a rather surprising departure of its own. It's a new style which seems to look back to earlier composers, including particularly Haydn. And we find when we're rehearsing this piece that we're often talking about the pauses and the surprises and the wit that we might talk about in a Haydn quartet.
Is it, sometimes people make a distinction between middle period Beethoven as being public music, but late Beethoven taking us into a much more private, intimate, inner world?
I don't think it's quite so straightforward. There are public works from the last years, like the Missa Solemnis or the Ninth Symphony, just as there are private and non-heroic pieces from the middle period, the Fourth Symphony or some of the piano sonatas, or indeed earlier quartets.
It's a complicated situation because with the late quartets, the players are getting more used to playing them in rooms for perhaps 150 people. And while it's true that some of the expression in the pieces are very intimate and there's a sense of a transcendence and a confessional, you're playing for a bigger audience and you're trying to draw the audience into those moments. And the musicologist Joseph Kerman has talked about the audience having a role somehow as eavesdroppers in these late quartets.
Well, let's remind ourselves of the sound of Beethoven in heroic mode. Here he is composing music with a story or program, in this case, appropriately, about a fateful hero, Coriolan. Just the year before, Beethoven composed an earlier group of quartets known as the Razumovsky Quartets, after the Russian Count, the Tsar's ambassador to Vienna, who commissioned them. When players first came across them and proclaimed them not music, Beethoven's answer was, "Oh, they are not for you. They are for a later age." Ed, your book about the quartets is called Beethoven for a Later Age. What do you think he meant by that?
Yes, I mean, that retort he gave was to a rather arrogant violinist, if you can imagine such a phenomenon. And I think probably what he meant was it takes time and patience to explore this music. And I think maybe one of the issues nowadays with listening to the Beethoven, the late quartets especially, is that if you're having an experience as a listener or a player and you find something a bit hard to grasp, maybe one feels a little bit embarrassed. I certainly felt that way. And I think instead one needs to embrace the moments that are confusing and disorienting and recognize that when your expectations are being confounded is actually precisely the sort of space where you may have a really remarkable experience.
People talk about late style with reference to, you know, all sorts of artistic figures. Are there aspects of this, the sort of feeling that the rules don't have to be adhered to, on the one hand, and also no longer the requirement for resolution?
I think the lack of requirement for resolution is important, but actually so are the rules. This isn't entirely free music. It's music that really self-consciously is aware of what it's doing in terms of stepping beyond the boundaries of what's acceptable. And I think that's one of the reasons why it has the longevity that it has. It's still asking questions about how do we make sense of this music and how you can then begin to say it's the style actually is tricky because you haven't got anything consistent there. In fact, it's this lack of consistency, which is what is emblematic of it.
Well, we're going to turn back a little to hear now a movement from the second of Beethoven's so-called late quartets, his Opus 130, which we talked about earlier in the week. How much of those characteristics on show in this opening movement?
Beethoven's questioning the very building blocks of what a first movement should be and what a theme or a melody should sound like. They're not absent, but they are fragmented and everything is made uncertain.
As a player, it's quite hard to deal with the changes, the fragments. It makes one feel somewhat fragmented. And I think that that sense of being fractured or fragmented in some way is a very deeply human experience, and it's rather wonderful that Beethoven creates it so vividly.
And what I really love is that people continue to debate it. So for some people it sounds chaotic and incomprehensible, and for others it's actually that's something that really speaks to their experiences. So I think the fact that you can still have a debate about it, it's not been decided, but is part of its power.
Ed, if you look on YouTube at some of the comments on performances by you and your fellow members of the Tokarczuk Quartet of the music we've been listening to all week, people say things like, this was a revelatory experience, an epiphany, divinely inspired, the closest thing to perfect music, music which bridges the gap between earth and a higher realm. Part of what makes these late quartets so exceptional is the way in which Beethoven seems to forge a spiritual connection with audiences that few composers have managed to achieve. What do you think it is about this music, Ed, that's capable of doing that?
It's an extraordinary combination of things. I think the emotional range we've been discussing in all the programs this week, the very varied use of time. There's sometimes a sense of hurtling forward motion and other moments of great suspension of time stopping. And I think also there's an amazing sense in which this music sort of holds a mirror up to one and you can recognize emotions in it that maybe you didn't even realize that you had inside of you.
Nora, what is it for you?
Part of it is historical, I think, that these works have become so venerated and are presented as such special objects that concerts of them sometimes can feel almost like you're attending some kind of religious ceremony. And then on a more personal level, when they're played well, and when you get caught up in this music, it stops you in your tracks and it frees your imagination and does that thing of allowing you to imagine, as Ed was saying, things you haven't yet experienced, or that maybe you never will experience, but you have access to articulating what that might feel like.
Ed, performing these pieces over and over as you do, how do you sustain the sense of the extraordinarily powerful things going on in this music?
It's funny that whenever we come back to them, all four of us have very strong feelings. There feels about how to play the music. It feels like there's an awful lot at stake. So as long as we have enough time to rehearse, it's an ongoing exploration and a sense that there are limitless possibilities in the way one could interpret the pieces.
Laura Tunbridge, I know you particularly love the end of that movement from the Opus 135. What in it specially speaks to you?
I just love the harmony, the slow descent and the bass line and the chromatic nuances and inflections, the way the weaving lower voices of the quartet have such warmth. And then the last 12 bars in particular, the first violin's melody reaches up into the stratosphere, but just holds back. It's just always on the cusp. It just leaves you tantalised.
What we heard there, the second and third movements of Beethoven's String Quartet in F major, his Opus 135, played by the Tokyo Quartet. We've been talking about the concept of late work in the context of Beethoven's sequence of last string quartets. Do you think this idea of late Beethoven, like the last works of Titian and Rembrandt in the visual arts, has had an influence on the way we think about the work of other composers?
To be sure, late Beethoven has become a model for thinking about the pattern of a composer's career, that their last works can be or should be somehow marked by a greater profundity. And that notion that difficult music's time will come, or that the best music is the most complex, is something that histories of modernism are still trying to grapple with.
We've spent the whole week calling these Beethoven's late quartets. Ed, your recordings with the Tokarczuk Quartet and ones issued by other quartets are marketed in that way when they're presented as sets. How meaningful is that label?
In one way, it makes sense because, of course, Beethoven wrote them at a specific time in his life. But perhaps it has a danger that we then don't see such innovation and radical ideas in his earlier works. And there are certainly places in the Opus 18 quartets, for example, where you can see some of the same innovations and experimentation that he then again explores in the late quartets. And I think as a player, you have to really view each piece as its own universe and not think too much about the overall genre.
We're coming to the final movement of the final quartet now. On the score, Beethoven has written, Der schwer gefasste Entschluss, the resolution reached with difficulty. Ed, the music asks a question.
Yes, it's a funny story here. It's written in the music, muss es sein, must it be, and then es muss sein, and it sounds tremendously fateful and philosophical, but actually originally this was a retort to an amateur player who asked to borrow the parts for Opus 130, but Beethoven knew he hadn't actually attended the concert and therefore hadn't paid his subscription fee. And so he wouldn't give him the parts unless this guy coughed up for them. And the person wrote to him, well, you know, must it be? And Beethoven wrote, yes, it must be. But by the time it finds its way into the quartet, I'm sure that Beethoven's not only thinking about this financial aspect. And many people have written about what he means and is this a kind of a acceptance of fate. But I feel that also Beethoven's having a bit of a joke at our expense. And certainly as the music evolves, there's a tremendous sense of humour in the fast music.
Laura, the end then of the last quartet, what should we listen out for this time?
Actually, very simply, the humour of it, as Ed has just mentioned. There's at the very, very end, after all of that fateful questioning, you just have a playful pizzicato ending and everything comes tumbling down to the final two chords.
Ed and Laura, we spoke about how these late quartets were intended by Beethoven for a later age. What do they mean to our age?
Yes, it's a very good question, something I think about a lot. I think that we see many examples of very snap judgments, kind of a crudeness in a debate between differing opinions. And I think what we see in the late quartets, extraordinary contradictions, ambiguities coexisting. And so I think this is very inspiring in these late quartets, that actually out of opposition and contrast, divisiveness, you can create great beauty if you're willing to embrace all of the different elements.
And Laura?
I think in part that this music still has a sense of opening up possibilities in its scale and ambition and in promising access to other worlds. And to later ages, I think one of the really telling things about this music is you can hear it in your youth and continue to return to it throughout your life and get something different from it, something more from it perhaps, but certainly something that accompanies you. And I think it's that sense of perspective and breadth which really lends it value.
Well, thank you both, Laura Tunbridge and Ed Dusenberry, very much indeed for all your enlightening comments this week.
Thank you.
Thanks.